Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. In today's podcast, recorded in 1982, 20 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, a panel of four members of President John F. Kennedy's executive committee reconvene to reflect on the lessons learned during the confrontation. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Gentlemen, some time ago, when some of us met with Secretary Rusk to discuss the Cuban Missile Crisis, we skirted the Secretary of Defense's perspective, Robert McNamara's perspective, because he wasn't there. He had tried to get there, but weather prevented. He is here today, and without inhibiting any of the rest of you, I would like to open up by asking him the first questions, beginning, Bob, with the issue: how did you see the nature of the problem when you first became aware that the Soviets were emplacing missiles in Cuba? What did you think the situation was and required?
Well, to begin to think about possible ways of reacting, one had to start there. And it took some time for the group of us that were considering it to come to any consensus on the nature of the problem, because there was an obvious disagreement between those on the one hand who saw a great increase in strategic nuclear power, the Soviet Union, very close to the U.S., 90 miles away, and those of us who saw it but didn't believe that it in any way changed the strategic nuclear balance. And I think ultimately we came to that conclusion that the U.S. had had a great superiority, numerical superiority in strategic nuclear power before the Soviet moves into Cuba. But that superiority, numerical superiority, was not such that it could be translated into usable military power to support political objectives. Because before the missiles were placed in Cuba, before the bombers were placed in Cuba, the Soviets had enough strategic nuclear power to face us with the prospect of unacceptable damage if we used ours first against them, or if we used ours in any fashion against them. And therefore, in a very real sense, we believed before the forces were put into Cuba that we were deterred from using our strategic nuclear forces.
That depends on your conception of
deterrence,
of unacceptable damage.
Yes, it does, exactly. And the belief I held then, the belief I hold today is that a president of the United States feels that his first responsibility is to protect this nation. And he is unwilling, I think, certainly that was true of President Kennedy and President Johnson after him, and I believe it would be true of most U.S. presidents, they would be unwilling to consciously sacrifice an important part of our population or our land and place it in great jeopardy to a strike by Soviet strategic forces, whether it be one city or two cities or three cities. And before the weapons were placed in Cuba, the Soviet Union had the power to respond to U.S. strategic nuclear action in ways that would endanger one or more of our cities. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we felt deterred from using our numerical superiority. And that was not changed by the introduction of nuclear weapons into Cuba. That doesn't mean to say we didn't have a problem that we needed to react to, but it began to place the nature of that problem in a somewhat different context than it first appeared.
Why do anything? If you have no strategic problem, why not just say, ho-hum, missiles in Cuba, so what?
I think that we felt then, certainly I felt then and feel now, that the Soviets did not wish a large-scale war with the West. But that they will probe for weakness, we've seen that many times. We saw it in 1961 when they put pressure on Berlin, for example. We've seen it many times since. They will probe for weakness, and they will take advantage of weakness when they find it. And that weakness can be either military or political or both. And the great danger in this situation was not that the military balance had been changed, because as I've suggested to you, we didn't believe that it had, but rather that if we failed to react, that the Soviets would believe, and as a matter of fact, the American public and the publics of the Western European nations would believe, the political balance had been changed. The Soviets would recognize weakness, and they would move to take advantage of that weakness, political weakness. And it was that fear, or that belief, that led us to the conclusion we had to react in some fashion. But our reaction should be addressed to the problem. And the problem was not, strictly speaking, in the narrow sense, a military problem.
Could one just add on that point that long before we were faced with any kind of calculation of whether there was a change in the strategic balance, that is to say, during the summer when the rumors began, the president had clearly thought about it and had said that he didn't believe they would do anything as dangerous as to put offensive weapons into Cuba, but that if they did, the gravest issues would arise. And without presuming to know everything that was in his head when he said that, he clearly wasn't thinking about how many missiles of who, what weight in which place, but rather about what it would mean if the Soviet Union thought it could put thermonuclear weapons in the Western Hemisphere after a warning that this really would be conduct that the American people would take the gravest view of. And just as an additional point, I think one has to bear in mind that in thinking about this, we had also to ask ourselves what our own country would think. And it was very clear that public reaction to this action would be, if anything, stronger than anything we were considering in that first week. I'm not trying to change the point, but only to add one element in what is this issue.
So that action, despite warning, even if the warning was in fact belated, the warning had been given. It was a public act.
Warning.
And yes, and there is one other element which, at least in my mind, played a role, not the key role, but certainly a significant role. And that was that the Soviets deliberately acted in deceit, that this was the most flagrant kind of deception on their part. They were constantly giving us assurances that they were not doing this when, in fact, they were going ahead and doing it. Even after we learned that we had full proof that they were doing it, we were still getting that kind of denial. And we could not be in a position of accepting an act of deception without some kind of reaction, apart from the other considerations that have been mentioned.
Yes, in that connection, I think it's useful to recall Gromyko's conversation with the president after we had discovered the missiles there.
In other words, if we're going to live in a world with the Soviet Union, and where the relations is almost by definition somewhat adversarial, we have to insist on a certain pattern of conduct on their side. And if we accept an act of deception without a reaction, then it seems to me we simply encourage them to continue deception, and that makes any kind of modus vivendi impossible.
Well, now, Khrushchev said in his memoirs, if indeed they were his memoirs, that on the one hand, these weapons were intended for defensive purposes, so that they were outside the president's warning, because the president had distinguished defensive from offensive. And second, that the Russians kept it secret to try to be helpful to Mr. Kennedy. They didn't want to create trouble for him before the congressional elections. How about that, George?
Well, I think that's manifest nonsense. Given all the circumstance, this is an excuse that he might have used with his own people, but it certainly was not persuasive to any American.
How did you get into the defensive-offensive distinction, which may have confused them?
The distinction was really not defensive-offensive. The distinction was conventional nuclear, and this was a polite way of talking about it. And Mr. Khrushchev can play games with that in his memoirs, but he was not in any doubt, and nobody else was. And really, to have accepted that form of words as a cover and a means of saying, oh, it doesn't matter, would have fooled nobody, least of all ourselves.
I can't recall that at the time they even made any allegation that they were defensive. Now, he does in his memoirs. But they did not when this was all exposed.
They maintained that we were the only ones who said they were offensive. You recall at the end, He says, we will withdraw the weapons which you consider offensive.
Which you call consider, yes, right. That's right, yes.
Mm-hmm. But all that's
That's word games, yes.
Well, Bob, given the problem definition, what about the alternatives?
Well, then the question was how to react. And as I've said, the fact that we didn't think it changed the strategic nuclear balance, I think, pointed our reactions in certain ways. But within the general direction we considered we should move, there were several different alternatives we considered, ranging from blockade or quarantine on the one hand to invasion on the other. As one looks back on that period, I think we would have to recognize a paranoia among the American people with respect to Cuba. It existed for a number of years. There were some, certainly some parts of our public and some in the Congress and in the executive branch who believed that Castro was such a threat that we should take this opportunity to invade and overthrow Castro. That was one extreme. Another extreme was the view of those who felt that we should seek to put sufficient pressure on Khrushchev to force him to remove the offensive weapons or to make them inoperable. But no more than was required to do that, and with the least danger of some undesirable Soviet reaction. And that group put forward the blockade. In between, there were other alternatives, the possibility of what was called a surgical strike, perhaps 50 sorties by aircraft against the sites designed to destroy the weapons. As we began to consider these alternatives, we very quickly moved to a consideration I think points to lessons applicable today, a consideration of how the Soviets would react. We couldn't just assume that we would blockade and they would do nothing. We couldn't assume that if we invaded and destroyed the Castro government, they would do nothing. And therefore, as we laid out the alternatives, we debated how the Soviets would respond and how we would respond. And we had to assume in each case they would respond. And some of the potential responses were very dangerous indeed. I mentioned three alternatives: blockade or quarantine, surgical airstrike against the offensive weapons, and at the other extreme, an invasion. Very soon it became clear that a surgical airstrike could probably not remain surgical, that a strike of 50 sorties against the offensive weapons would probably have to be enlarged to take out Cuban air defense, including their fighter bases, and probably raised to such a degree that almost surely it would involve an invasion. And we then began to consider how the Soviets would respond alternatively to a quarantine versus some form of military pressure, possibly involving either a large airstrike and or an invasion. And we had to conclude there was a high risk that they would respond to some pressure on Berlin, on Turkey, on other parts of NATO. And these were factors that were taken into account and ultimately led, I think, to almost unanimous support for the quarantine.
Bob, I should add there, I think, that there was some support. I don't say it was given very much consideration for the so-called diplomatic approach. That is, that we should tell the Soviets that we've discovered the weapons, and working through the UN and diplomatic sources, tried to persuade them to remove the weapons.
Yes.
I'd not say that that was really a serious alternative, but it was advocated, though.
Yes, and I think it was associated, at least by some supporters of that, Alex, associated with the thought that one could start with a diplomatic approach, and
that's
if
right.
that were not successful,
and,
it
and
could,
then move, and then
we
move
could then,
the scale.
In a
that's
sense,
right.
escalate into
that's
military
right.
action.
That's right. Yes.
Which, by the way, was one of the main arguments in favor put forward by those who favored the quarantine, that if one started with the quarantine, a relatively, I'll call it, low level of military action, if it didn't succeed, one could move, if thought desirable, to higher levels of military mm-hmm. action. Well, but the important point I want to make here is that very early on in the consideration of these alternative responses, we began to consider how the Soviets would respond to the response. And we recognized the potential escalation beyond what we would perhaps have in mind when we took the first step.
Yes, there was another point, I think, which is associated with that, and that is that unless the installation of a blockade resulted in the sinking of a Soviet ship, no irrevocable act had been taken which required or made imperative a response on the Soviet side. Mm-hmm. There would be time, possibly, for conversation, and this thing might be sorted out. Once an irrevocable act had been taken, whether a surgical airstrike or an invasion or something of that kind, then the Soviets would be compelled to do something in the nature of retaliation. So what we were doing was buying time for a dialogue, having made clear our position as a very firm position, putting it up to the Soviet Union to have the option of withdrawal without creating a situation where some kind of retaliation would be imperative.
In short, we did not need to start the shooting.
That's right.
No, it didn't need to. We didn't want to. If we could get those weapons out without shooting,
we
wanted to get
them out.
That's
what I say. It did not require us. All the other courses of action required us to start shooting.
And an irrevocable act. I think this was a very significant point.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's... Okay, I accept that point. Now take the other side of it. If it is implicit in the quote, surgical strike, that has to be a big surgical strike, and it probably has to be followed by an invasion, which is what I think I heard you say. Why did that remain a live option for 4 days? You know, 20 years later, it seems like a hell of a way to use military power. How long did you think it would take you to get rid of the guerrilla actions in Cuba after you started on that course?
No, it wasn't as much that deterred us from the invasion route, but rather the recognition that an invasion would cause the death of a substantial number of Americans. Mm-hmm. And we made some very rough estimates, and one can argue about them, but we recognized the possibility 25,000 Americans might die in the process. B, that there would be very substantial loss of Cuban life.
Mm-hmm.
And C, that almost surely the Soviets would have to respond mm-hmm. in areas outside
right.
of Cuba.
You're
quite correct in implying that if we had an invasion, apart from the loss of life, ours and theirs, we would have had a very serious problem of stabilizing the situation in Cuba.
A lot of Russians would have been killed.
And a lot of Russians would have been killed. And almost surely the Soviets, both because some Russians were killed in Cuba and because in a sense we had confronted them with a military challenge, would feel it necessary, so we thought, to respond elsewhere in the world. And we then would be faced into possible response elsewhere in the world. So we saw this, the danger of escalation, and I think it was that action-reaction recognition that led us to wish to achieve our objective, a very limited objective. We weren't seeking to overthrow Castro. We weren't seeking to change the relationship of Cuba to the United States. We were seeking only one thing, the removal of the offensive missiles and aircraft. And we wished to achieve that at the lowest possible risk. And we recognized that if we failed to achieve that by applying a quarantine, we still had the option, should we wish to exercise it, of moving to the next higher level of risk.
Yeah. Can I go back to your question, which is why did the airstrike stay alive as long as it did? Well, I think there were a lot of reasons for that. One was that the first reaction of so many people was, well, you know, they have done this. We didn't think they would.
Secrecy.
They have surprised us. The obvious thing to do is to take them out. Simple-minded phrase, but it occurred to many people. It's what mm-hmm. the president said to me the very first morning. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that he stuck with it or that it was in any sense a final response. It happened again when the members of Congress were briefed the following Monday. It was the very strong reaction of Dean Acheson, mm-hmm. who had been a kind of elder statesman and advisor to the administration precisely on the question of Soviet danger, particularly around Berlin, but more generally. And in addition, I had feelings about, there were weaknesses to the blockade, which we don't need to take time on now. But the most important point, I think, and one that we should hear from Bob McNamara about, was that the uniformed military leaders, who were highly disciplined in the end, I think, about accepting the course the president laid down, were very strongly of the opinion that this was a provocation which required a prompt and effective military response. And for them, that meant military action against the island of Cuba. And I think it would be important for Bob to tell us, not the whole story, because we need to hear from the military, but his view of the problem of working with the military in that first week of consultation.
Well, I want to go back to one of the points Mac made. The support for a massive airstrike and or an invasion was the first reaction of most people confronting the problem. He mentioned the congressional representatives. The Congress was not consulted or briefed until, as you recall, on the Monday following the decision of Sunday to initiate the blockade action. And I think I'm correct in saying that almost unanimously, the members of Congress opposed the president's decision to initiate a blockade and favored much stronger military action, either a large airstrike or invasion. That was the immediate reaction of most people confronting the problem. And I think one of the lessons to be learned from this situation is that one should not act on one's immediate reaction. One should take time to think through the implications of that and alternative courses of action, because those of us who did have the time to think it through, as the members of Congress did not, changed our minds or gained support for an initial position contrary to that view. Now, why did those who supported the invasion alternative continue to hold that view after they'd had time to think of the possible reaction? And I think because they viewed the Soviet threat in a different way. Was one reason. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think they felt, and we were never able to test the validity of this thought, but I think they felt that an invasion might be more costly if it were deferred rather than put forward as the initial response. If we started with a quarantine and ultimately had to move to an invasion, the Soviets would have had time to prepare for it, both militarily and politically, and not only on the island of Cuba, but with potential responses and perhaps more dangerous responses elsewhere in the world. So those were their reasons. I think they were wrong. I think with hindsight, we were right in starting with the quarantine, but it was not an easy decision for many of the members of the executive committee to come to.
Because the quarantine could fail of the minimal objective that its proponents had set for it. That is, it failed to remove those missiles, leaving you then with
what to do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
in a sense with a more dangerous situation, because then we could hardly, having instituted a quarantine.
Then you have to go up.
And having failed to achieve a narrow objective, it would have been very difficult not to escalate to the next step for which the Soviets would have had more time to prepare. And I think that was the argument used by many in favor of going to higher escalation.
There was another element which played a role in this, and which I think Bobby Kennedy made clearer than anyone. And when he said, "My brother will not be the Tito of 1961,"
or the Tito either.
The Tito, well, the Tojo in this case, meaning that. A surprise attack was all too reminiscent of Pearl Harbor. A surprise attack would be something that would be out of character for a great nation such as the United States. Nevertheless, if we had immediately responded with what was the instinct, as Bob McNamara suggested, of a number of people, we'd immediately responded with an airstrike. It would have been a secret airstrike, an unannounced airstrike, presumably. And that the United States would have been held up in the world as a country who attacked a small country and took it by surprise in a very unattractive way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I recall it. Bobby's point on that affected many members of the XCOM who were up to that point.
Well, I had made a statement very early on, which was certainly representative of a deep conviction I had, that every nation has to act out of character, in character, and if it acts out of character, it destroys itself to some extent. Mm-hmm. And Bobby said it very much better later on when he said, my brother will not be the Tojo.
If I understand correctly, what happened in the week you had this time, or the 4 or 5 days you had time, and we can later ask what happens if you don't have time, is the decision which is more costly, the small start or the big one, is argued out. But something else is argued out. What are the minimal objectives for which we're going to act at all here? Did I get that right?
Well,
and that not everybody involved was satisfied with those minimal objectives.
There's another way of stating that, and again, I think Bob is in a very strong position to help to clarify it. I think that what your objectives were depended on who you chose to make your target, and vice versa. If you were strongly in favor of dealing with the Castro problem, with this as a kind of opportunity to do so, mm-hmm. then your objective was not to have a treaty with Castro. Mm-hmm. It was to get rid of him. Mm-hmm. And that goes with, in general, the position that favors very strong action against the island of Cuba. Not everybody, but in general. If, on the other hand, you thought that this was a problem which posed the gravest of dangers between the United States and the USSR, then your objective would be to deal with the problem which created that danger, which was the missiles, neither more nor less.
Right.
And if you reached the second conclusion, then you would frame the whole enterprise around Soviet responses, as Bob has already suggested. What will they do? And you would regard Cuba and Castro himself as not only as dependent variables, but as dependent variables of very low weight. I don't know whether that's
I think Mac has explained it very well. There was among our people at the time a paranoia with respect to Cuba. Very common. It was held by the public, and it was held by members of Congress, and so by some members of the executive branch.
And we'd campaigned on it, in fairness.
And it was perhaps understandable, but that doesn't make it something one should yield to. However, this was an opportunity for those who felt that way to suggest, let's deal with our Cuban problem. And it was that feeling that led some to support a proposed invasion. I think the president ultimately decided, and I think the executive committee agreed, the problem was that we were going to deal with was not a Cuban problem. The problem was a Soviet problem. And we should look upon it as such. It was a potential change in the balance of relationships, not between the U.S. and Cuba, not even between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, but rather between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. And we should think of it in those terms. And we should take the minimum action required to restore the previous balance between the Warsaw Pact and NATO, and allow the Cuban problem to remain whatever it was before, and deal with it in some way, other way in the future. Initially the major difference of opinion between those who wished to invade Cuba on the one hand versus those who suggested
I think we should press this point, because if I recollect correctly, there was nobody that I recall outside the military and the very top of the intelligence, where I think perhaps John McComb may have shared this general view, who held the view that the problem was to be framed in terms of cutting out the Cuban cancer. And therefore, the fact that this opinion was not pressed harder on the president than it was has a great deal to do with the judgment rendered and expressed for the Defense Department by Mr. McNamara. And I think anything he can tell us about the way that argument progressed in the Pentagon is important, because it didn't go very far in those terms in the XCOM, at least as
well,
I recollect it.
I think in the Pentagon, the views differed. I know you will talk to General Taylor, and I would wish him to express his own view, but my recollection of his view was that he, in contrast to some of the other chiefs, did not favor an invasion in order to overthrow Castro and change the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. But there were strong feelings in the Pentagon that we should take advantage of this situation, an opportunity, some called it, to solve a problem that we'd lived with for 3 or 4 years before then, and that it was feared would adversely affect us in the future. And therefore, there was strong support among some quarters in the Pentagon for the invasion route for exactly that reason. There were others in the Pentagon who felt regardless of whether we weaken Castro or not, we would need to apply more pressure on Khrushchev than would be applied by a blockade if we wished to force him to take those offensive weapons out or make them inoperable. And they were the ones who supported initially the surgical strike and moved later to a recognition or a belief that it could not remain surgical, and therefore one should plan on an initial large-scale air attack, which they also recognized would very likely be followed by an invasion, which might have the incidental effect of overthrowing Castro, but would not have been initially directed toward that end.
One other element which again might be mentioned, and that is that the effect of limiting action to a quarantine, at least as the initial step, was that it tended to localize any possible Soviet response. They could respond by trying to run their ships through, but the response to a quarantine wouldn't be a bombardment of the missile bases in Ankara, wouldn't be a pressure on Berlin. This wouldn't be appear to be the indicated response. On the other hand, an airstrike could very well have triggered that kind of retaliation against Berlin, or even against very specifically against Turkey, which would have caused a great deal of problems for us, because we had our missiles in Turkey at that time.
We considered the problem of a Soviet strike against Turkey because we had missiles there, and there was some apparent balance, Cuban missiles, Turkish missiles. And there was certainly the possibility that the Soviets would respond to our airstrike on Cuba by some pressure on Turkey. And we couldn't have tolerated a Soviet strike on Turkey without a response. And it was that action-reaction and the potential escalation that we took great account of in examining and evaluating the alternatives. And we had time to do it. And I come back to this importance of the time. It took time to do this. It took time for our own thinking to recognize the danger of Soviet response, the alternative forms of that response, and the need to our response to the response.
In other words, a Soviet bombing of the missiles in Turkey would have triggered the whole NATO treaty mechanism.
I hope we can come back to this question of time to consider this, because I think that was one of the keys, and that we were able to handle. The president and the XCOM were able to keep the security on the issue and on the consideration of responses to it within a small group, which gave that group time to think about and talk these things through, free from the pressures of outside influence.
One could almost draw a law from this. Within certain limits, the longer the time taken to form the decision, the more sound the decision will be.
Yeah.
I'm certain that was true within
very much so.
four, five, 6 days in this case.
We were lucky in one regard, that is, we discovered the missiles before they were operative.
Yes.
If the missiles had been operative at the time we discovered them, I think we would have felt rather different.
Yes, I remember during that week, you recall,
logically,
that's the thing
wouldn't
we were
have
been
any
for.
Difference, but psychologically, it would have been
but
a
I'd
very
still
big
put
one.
Forward my law. That's even if we hadn't true. Discovered the missiles until after they were operative, I think
we
the
still,
longer the time we would have taken to consider how to react, the more sound our reaction would be.
Oh, yes.
Within certain limits.
Let's linger on that one moment, though, because the thing that we all remember about the time we had was we had it in part, and really in very large part, because nothing had leaked.
Yes.
Because certainly right. one story in the newspapers would have changed the environment of the discussion, and we all wanted not to do that, and we wanted to preserve what turned out to be very valuable, the president's right, in effect, to set the terms of
yes.
the crisis by his own announcement before there were
yes.
leaks.
Yeah.
Now, accepting Bob's law that the more time the better, I think one has to add another law that has developed in the last 20 years, which is likely there'll be less time than there was the last time because
yeah.
things leak much faster in the government of the United States than they did 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. Unless you're determined, and this may be your point, to take the time in spite of the leaks.
Well, I am,
yeah,
Mac, determined to take the time in spite of leaks, or would recommend
sure.
to the executive branch they take the time in spite of leaks. But B, I would urge that the executive branch, the public, and the media
think
about this whole problem. I'm not suggesting that the media should not report whatever they know under most circumstances, but I am suggesting there are certain circumstances, and I would suggest that the consideration of the use of military power is one of those, where the president and the executive branch are constituted authorities who have the decision-making power to apply military power, should be given time to think through the problem. And the members of the executive branch should recognize a greater responsibility to avoid leaks under those circumstances than perhaps they do otherwise. And the public should be more tolerant of secrecy in the executive branch under those circumstances, as should be the media. Now, maybe those are hard rules of conduct to adhere to, but I suggest that we should at least talk about those in our society.
I like your other one, too. I've never heard it discussed before,
yeah.
which is if the media and the public and all don't act in the way, and that the bureaucracy does not act in the way that you would think appropriate, you're saying the chief officials of the government should not let publicity precipitate them into action.
Now, I understand the cost
of that. Is that what you're
saying? I am saying that. And I want to very quickly say I understand the cost of that, because you give up surprise or some element of surprise, perhaps. And by giving up surprise or tactical surprise, you pay a potential cost.
You may, not always.
You may. And what I'm suggesting to you is, in my view, in most situations, the potential cost associated with giving up surprise is less than the potential cost of making a decision without having thought through its consequences.
Bob, I hate to think, however, if what would have happened if there had been a really serious leak on, say, Tuesday instead of Friday, when the New York Times finally did get the story.
Well, I hate to think of it, but that's why I'm suggesting the law. Because
right.
I really think the greatest lesson I took out of this, George, is the increasing soundness of the decision with the passage of time.
I agree, but I'm just trying to think how we could have held off for 3 or 4 or 5 days with the country screaming at us, when are you going to react, what are you going to do, with speeches in the Congress, with resolutions being passed, with demonstrations in the streets. The country would have been up
and
arms.
And well, giving the Soviets during that period a time to decide they were going to do.
Right,
let
me suggest to you how we could have reacted. And the only reason I want to dwell on this is that we're going to face these situations in the future. There's no question about it in my mind. And the great temptation is to respond to the public pressure And if you accept my law that the response is likely to increase in wisdom with the passage of time, you pay a very heavy price to respond to the pressure. So, accepting what George said,
let me suggest
how we should have responded if it had leaked on Tuesday. The president should have said, I am determined to protect this nation. The security of this nation is my number one responsibility. At the same time,
of course, the advantage we had was, with no leak whatsoever, the Soviets had no contingency plan to deal.
Well, that's right. So he starts by saying that.
Yeah, and they would have had more time to develop their contingency plan.
But as an indication of that, I am pulling up the reserves. I am moving air squadrons. I am consulting with my allies. Mm-hmm. I'm not arguing that this is...
I'm going to the UN. There are lots of things that don't finally commit you that you can do for time.
The point I'm trying to make is all of you, we've all served together. We all know these terrible pressures. Yes. And there is an immense temptation to respond by immediate military action.
That's right.
And I'm suggesting it's dangerous.
There's one other point that was implied but not stated, and that is, had there been a leak on Tuesday and an uproar in the United States, and I totally agree with what Bob has just said as to what the objective should have been, there were two dangers. Not only that the Soviet Union would have time to reply, but that the Soviet Union would reply precipitously and lock itself in so that a solution would have been possible.
Yes, that would have been
Khrushchev saying something, just... Again, not taking the time to think it through.
Yeah, that's right.
And this is the kind of action and reaction that really leads to deep, deep trouble.
Well, I think we all agree thoroughly upon Bob's law.
But I think what we ought to do, I mean, the implication, what I'm saying is, we ought to persuade the Soviets to do the same thing. So if we have this kind of mutually understood law, that nobody's going to react in a hurry.
Well, and that's a conclusion I'd come. In this nuclear age, isn't that one of the things we ought to spend more time thinking about? Mm-hmm. We do an awful lot of talking about reducing the numbers of nuclear weapons, but we ought to also think about how to reduce the risk of use. And one of the ways to do that is to convince the Soviets that together, we ought to communicate more and take more time on whatever element of confrontation there is between us.
There's a great deal to be said for that, and we really need to have a better mechanism, it seems to me, for agreeing with
absolutely.
Rather than starting at the summit.
And when you say mechanism, I take it you're not just talking about, although we need it, a more sophisticated, quicker, more rapidly translated hotline. You're talking about a process of communication which involves people,
that's right.
Units, assignments, customs, practices.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sustained method of making sure that communication precisely about the things in which we have the gravest disagreements exists
and can be used. Yes.
Stockpiling things to do publicly while you're thinking, both for the media's sake and the public's sake and with the Soviets, seems to me, I haven't heard that before. I think it's very important because no new administration would have your list of calling up the reserve.
I think that's an important point, that you need to have some experience of these options. There are military options, there are diplomatic options, there are political options. One of the most obvious, which we did not use in this case for our own reasons, is consultation with the Congress.
Yes.
And consultation with the Congress need never be a merely one-shot affair.
No. And it can take an infinite amount of time.
The Congress, if it thinks that the administration is too strong, is quite capable of having an initial reaction that is much more wary. This particular case, we have decided on an action which the congressional leaders find less strong than their own emotional reaction. But there are plenty of examples the other way. And I think we should not neglect at all in thinking about not only ways of thinking and ways of saving time, but about serious constitutional process. If we frame it that way, we will see that it's the exception, not the rule, that you wish to start a flaming crisis without a serious consultation with the Congress.
What you all were trying to do was not, quote, start a flaming crisis, but get the advantage of surprise.
in what was already by the factual situation.
Right. De facto,
crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah, a surprise that, yeah. And a reasoned.
Yeah, that's right.
Initiative, yes.
The state, minimum response necessary to achieve a narrow objective and after thoughtful consideration of alternatives.
Let me ask you something that has not come up before. If a number of people, civilians and military people, saw Cuba as the primary problem, or if not the primary problem, as an important secondary problem, take advantage of an opportunity to cure this secondary problem. It's like crossing the 38th parallel in 1950 because for 5 years the UN has been trying to unify Korea, so what the hell, let's get this too. Whether it's primary or secondary, a lot of people, you're saying, thought that here was a time to get the Cubans out of play. Now, had the government at the highest level between the Bay of Pigs in spring of 61 and this occasion in October of 62, at your level, had you ever decided that your policy was to live with Cuba? I know you decided it by the end of this crisis, because you gave a pledge by the end of the crisis. But had that policy decision ever been made?
No.
Otherwise, all the people who thought Cuba should be got rid of are acting on what they must assume is the administration's desire, even though fumbled in the spring of 61.
I think that it's even more severe than that. I think that after the Bay of Pigs, we did engage in a policy of confrontation with Cuba, accompanied by a program of covert action, which wasn't very effective, but that wasn't for lack of trying or for lack of pressure and initiative from the president on down. And it was a perfectly legitimate feeling for the rest of the executive branch to have that the administration really finds this regime deeply offensive, believes it's dangerous, and would welcome effective ways of getting rid of it. So that your question, which I'm sure is not wholly innocent, is correctly designed to bring out the fact that we had not reached the conclusion that we must live with this guy. We didn't even reach that conclusion after the missile crisis, because the covert enterprises continue well into 63, and it's really only in the fall of 63 that the president turns his own attention to the question of the search for alternatives.
All you gave up then in October, you gave up an overt invasion.
The overt
option.
Invasion. 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 What we gave up. Yes.
Well, I hadn't seen before that the upset about giving the two things, if I hear you right, two things are happening. At the top level of government, the risk in this confrontation between you and the people in Moscow is powerfully concentrating your minds on something that the rest of the government is entitled to have a fuzzy signal about, which would help explain why there was a sense among numbers of military people that you'd been pusillanimous, or you'd given up a great chance, or whatever the proper terms are.
I think that there was a feeling among, after the offensive weapons were removed from Cuba, I think there was a feeling among some members of the Congress, some members of the executive branch, including the military, and some members of the public, that we had missed an opportunity to overthrow Castro. I don't think there's any question about what that feeling existed.
We should have got more out of it.
You know, it was a rather common feeling among some groups. I think they're absolutely wrong, but the feeling existed. And in part it existed for just the reason you pointed to. There'd been no decision beforehand, before October 62, that the the government would not take advantage of an opportunity to possibly use military force or some other force to eliminate Castro.
And as you've said, it was a very popular notion in the United States.
The nation
States,
was paranoid.
In the country.
I don't want to say the administration. The nation was paranoid.
Without regard to the costs to us,
exactly.
Without regard to the fact that, quote, getting rid of Castro at that point could not be accomplished by a quarantine of missiles. That's
absolutely right.
It had to involve the initiation by the United States.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.